You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail.
You wait before the sunrise, and at 5 a.m. you get on the bus. The people look so resigned to the daily grind, and you swear it'll never be.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Intersections, presented by CITR's Intersectionality Collective. We're here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel of collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, sexuality, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
The city you live in is ugly. The city you live in is ugly. But it wasn't meant to be. No, it wasn't meant to be.
Welcome back to Intersections. This is Hal from the Intersectionality Collective, along with Brianna. Today, we have the honor of interviewing Kelsey, a queer anthropologist in training. Kelsey created the series Queer in Alberta on TikTok, YouTube, and Spotify. She has said that her aim with this project is to represent the historically underrepresented queer community of Alberta, and she has certainly achieved this goal. Only a year after starting this project, she received a TELUS StoryHive grant and is now working to create a TELUS documentary series about queer folks in Alberta. So to start us off today, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your work?
Yeah, all right. So my name is Kelsey. I like to introduce myself in both Tagalog and English because my mother is from the Philippines. So kumusta ako? Can you tell I'm a little nervous? Kumusta sa lahat? Ako ay si Kelsey. So that means, hello, my name is Kelsey. I guess my work, basically, I interview queer Albertans from here in Lethbridge, Alberta, which is on Treaty 7 territory, traditionally the home of the Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the Métis Nation. And I started this project because my whole life I've really spent in small towns or small cities, and I've always felt pretty disconnected from the queer community. And what I was really surprised to see is that when I started making videos on TikTok, lots of Albertans, whether they were from Calgary or Edmonton or towns even smaller than where I grew up, they felt the exact same way. So I thought to myself, okay, if we're all here, we're all queer, like clearly we need to start talking about it and making some noise. So I started to interview people, and that's what I do on TikTok, on my podcast, which is also on YouTube. And again, as a mixed race person of color, it's really important for me to share as diverse of voices as I can, because even when we think about how little exposure is already on the queer community, it's even smaller when you start breaking into the intersections, such as, say, race or gender or, you know, able-bodiedness and all these sorts of things.
Wonderful. And just going along with that, what kind of started your inspiration to start posting videos on TikTok, even before the Queer in Alberta series started?
Yeah, it's funny that you ask me that, because I actually deleted all of my social media right at the beginning of the pandemic, which I found was really good for me. I needed a bit of a break. But when we were all at home, not seeing each other in general, that piece of queer isolation that I was kind of speaking to, it just felt amplified to like the thousands without having any social media to then connect me to other queer people. So I kind of just started making content, more so, I guess, content, big quotation marks there, for my friends and for me. And it just started to gain more traction as more queer people started to see it. So yeah, I guess mainly just feeling a little lonely in Southern Alberta and wanting to maybe put a shout into the void and see if anybody else was there.
Yeah, along those lines, what was it like in the initial stages of beginning your show, both in starting to build connections with potential interviewees and the initial responses you got from TikTok?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when we talk about the show and all these sorts of things, I never started it thinking that it would ever become what it is, with it now being a telestory high funded program and all these sorts of opportunities that are coming our way. But yeah, I just started posting videos. And so basically, yeah, I just originally it all started because I made one video just talking again about that queer scarcity piece. And I actually posted it on my 25th birthday. And at the end of the video, I was like, hey, it's my birthday. And it would really make my day if some queer Albertans would say hi and prove that we're not alone in the prairies. And what I did not foresee at all with that video was that thousands of queer Albertans saw it, and they all wished me a happy birthday, which was, I'm never going to forget that. And when I just saw, like, again, that response of we're in Calgary or we're in a small town and we feel the same as you, I thought that there was so much happening in that moment that I wanted to seize that momentum. And I've always, like, I did my undergrad in anthropology, and so I've always had this kind of like project in the back of my brain where I thought about maybe interviewing queer Albertans to share their stories. And so I thought, okay, even though I'm in grad school, why not just add something else to the pile and do it now, because I've got the interest now. So I just posted another video asking if anybody would have a conversation with me. And I think now over 60 to 80 Albertans have emailed me wanting to schedule them, and I'm doing my best to catch up with everybody, but that's really how it took off.
And you mentioned that you did this all while studying your anthropology. How did your studies affect the way that you approached this project and sort of started to build it?
Oh my goodness. I think it would be impossible to separate the work that I do from an anthropological perspective. Like everything about my training from, like, you know, every university in anthro makes you take, like, if they're good, a methods and ethics kind of course, right? Where you think about how do you approach an interviewee without, you know, putting your own bias in too much, and how can you remain objective? Can you even do that? Asking all of those questions in my brain definitely positions how I formulate the questions that I ask people in these interviews through this series. So people think, what are you going to do with an anthropology degree? Or maybe I'm doing something so different now. And I would totally disagree, because everything about this work is anthropological.
You mentioned at the beginning that you felt kind of alone in Alberta. Mm-hmm. Has it changed at all?
I'd say definitely yes. Like, I read, if you haven't read it, and if you're interested in queer literature, I've started to read Prairie Fairies by, I think, Val Kilmer. And something that really struck out to me, even in the introduction, is that the author dictates how there's this been this kind of internalized idea in Alberta for queer people for decades now, from even the 1930s to the 1990s. That they are alone in the prairies. And it's so strange that that idea has persisted for so long, even as community has always been here. So with that being said, that kind of feeling of being alone, it's definitely, like, I still feel maybe like I don't see as many queer people. I don't feel very attached to a really large, vibrant queer community in a small city like Lethbridge. But when I think about where I am in this province, like, proportionally, I definitely feel much more connected, because many of the people that I've actually interviewed, I've had the privilege to call them friends now. And so it's really cool to be, like, checking in with people that I interviewed, or say maybe someone was starting the transition when we first talked, and now their voice is so different, and I get to hear about it on the phone or something, like how their life is going. So you definitely have queer supports and people that understand you. And it's building community, even if it's not directly in front of you.
And along with that, were you, when you started out the series and started on TikTok, were you aware of how big the queer community is on TikTok and the sort of support that you could tap in with starting the series?
I mean, I had an inkling. It's funny, my ex-girlfriend had TikTok. And at the time I was like, oh, TikTok is a dancing app. It's for kids. Like, I can't dance, firstly, so I don't want any part of it. But after we broke up, that's another part of the story. Like, having such a small queer community here meant that a lot of, like, the conversations that I could have about my queerness were with my previous partner. So when she and I weren't together anymore, I lost, like, that person that I could talk about that part of my identity with. So then I decided, like, after hearing a bit about TikTok, to download it. And of course, the For You page figured me out. It said that is gay 100%. And immediately I was seeing all this content. So I started to figure out how big it was pretty fast.
In my own experience on TikTok, I think you see a lot of people who talk about getting onto the wrong side of TikTok, which is maybe entering into spaces where people aren't as supportive. And yet at the same time, TikTok can be a really supportive environment where you've clearly found a home. So can you talk a bit about the positive and negative experiences that come with being vocally queer on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those positives and negatives, I think it's more subjective depending on who you talk to and how large their platform is. I recently went to It Gets Better Canada. Yeah, so I'm going to be working with them in the future for some really cool stuff that you can definitely ask me about soon. I can't say too much now, but I went to like their kind of panel, I guess, that they had, where they had three creators from Queer TikTok come and speak. And that was something they discussed, like things like shadow banning or winding up on the wrong side of TikTok. And so I haven't necessarily gotten like, I don't think my content has been seen by people that would maybe receive it in a hateful and negative way, because I've been really privileged not to have as many of those comments. But the issue that I'm struggling with right now is that, say, I post a video and then nobody is able to see it, which is really weird, because right when I started, like, TikTok was really pushing my content and it was taking off. And for me, like, the thing that's most upsetting about that is it's not about, like, you know, clout or anything for me, but this is clearly a project that means so much to people. And I know like the power of representation and visibility. So it just makes me really sad that people who follow me sometimes don't see any of the stuff that they followed me for.
Absolutely. There's definitely issues with TikTok and the general way that algorithms work in social media. And circle back to touch on sort of speaking to an audience. In a few of your videos, you do talk about if you could reflect back on your younger self, how you would perceive yourself now, how your younger self would feel. Can you talk a little bit what it's like to be on a public platform where you are reaching or have the potential to reach young queer people, and what it's sort of like to be aware of that as a creator and be able to look back on those experiences where you might have felt less alone as a young person?
Oh, boy. I think, you know, creating content for younger queer people is at the forefront of my mind. Like, representation, like I said, is important regardless of what age or part, like what part of your journey you're on in your life. But growing up in rural Alberta, like, I haven't talked too much about it, but I grew up in like a 5,000 population town, and it was not very diverse. I didn't really have any language or education to understand the feelings that I was feeling, let alone to know that it was that something as simple as being gay. I think about if I could have had, you know, a voice or a local representation that felt kind of familiar, like, you know, being from the same province, that never happens when we think of representation for queer people. It would have changed everything in my life, and maybe would have given me an avenue to, like, yeah, feel like everything was going to be okay and to understand myself. And so whenever I create the things that I do, I'm always thinking of that vulnerable younger population, because if I can do even a little to make things just a tiny bit easier for them than it was for me, regardless of where they are, like, that's the number one goal.
And I can say, as someone who grew up small town America, I fully see how important that representation is. And I had one of those people in my hometown, and it really, it is a benefit, especially those teenage years when you're figuring out that you're queer. Having those people are really, really important. And coming from the other side, I can definitely say that it's helping a lot of people.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's so sweet. And like, it's a little mortifying in some ways to think of people from my hometown, like, potentially perceiving me, A. But B, like, if it's something that somebody needs, because looking back, what was really interesting for me is so many people came out when we graduated from high school or when we moved away, right? And I just wish that queer youth didn't have to feel like they could only be themselves once they left home, because some of them don't have the privilege to leave home.
Yeah, absolutely. So to focus on some of the work that you're doing in the future, for our listeners who don't know, you were recently selected for the Tell Us Story Hive project. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and the work that you're doing?
Yeah. Something about me is that I think I'm very ambitious, but I'm also very like fly by the seat of my pants, doing everything in a chaotic whirlwind. So that's how I would describe this Tell a Story Hive opportunity. What I mean by that is, like, I saw it in the local paper here, actually in Lethbridge. And I thought, you know, I'd apply. I didn't think at all that I would get in. I waited until the night of like the application being due to apply. And like, I didn't open the application until that night. And it was like, you need to film a video. You need to do this. So here I was in my pajamas at like 11 p.m. trying to be like, hey, I'd be a great person to fund. but clearly, you know, something about that worked out. So now it's the StoryHive Voices 2.0 program that I was selected for. So 100 creators from BC and Alberta, they were given a $10,000 production funding grant along with training from industry experts. And so all of October was spent in that kind of pre-production phase where you were finding your interviewees, going to these training sessions, meeting with your cohort, which was really great. And now I'm in the full swing of production. So it's a little exciting, a little nerve-wracking, but I think it's going to turn out really well.
And just to follow up with that, when can an audience, do you have a timeline for when the audience can expect to see some of the StoryHive content come out?
Mm-hmm, I do. So it's going to be shooting for a summer 2023 release, and it'll be out on all of like TELUS's platforms and social media, but also on Optik TV. And I think they have like a million subscribers. So that's really freaking me out, but like in a great way. And yeah, so I'm doing like, it's like an episodic based thing, very similar to what we already have out. But as you can see, we've got new lighting, a new camera, some new audio. So that is all. Thank you to Bestie TELUS.
As you move forward with TELUS, do you see yourself staying on TikTok where you got your start, or do you think you're going to transition into different formats over time?
I don't know. It's been so interesting because I had a meeting with my like a production manager coordinator for my like assigned cohort with TELUS. And she was like, oh, like, you know, don't use up all your ideas. Like we could potentially do another season, all these sorts of things. And talking about my future career. And I'm like, Bestie, I'm doing a master's in anthropology. Like, what do you mean future career? This is so different. So I'm just like, you know, I feel like opportunities are knocking in so many different areas of my life. And as long as something feels good and like I'm doing good work that from an anthro perspective is not causing harm, that's what's important to me, whether it's on TikTok, whether it's continuing with TELUS, like, yeah, I do love the project. It's super fulfilling for me as a queer person to also hear all of these stories, not just for, you know, being able to be the conduit for other people to hear them.
Thank you for sharing all of your thoughts with us. Do you have any other thoughts or comments that you'd like to share about your experiences with TikTok or queer in Alberta? Anything that kind of you've come upon in your projects?
I guess the only thing is the shadow banning thing, which is really unfortunate. So I guess like for anyone that's listening that maybe is a fan of the series or wanting to get access to that content, it just means that you have to look a little harder. So whether that's directly searching me up if you haven't heard from me in a while or seen me on your For You page, with the podcasts and et cetera, you can always sign up for like notifications whenever I post something new. Same thing on YouTube. But yeah, that's really the only thing, because it's really frustrating when you spend a lot of time doing something that makes you feel really good and makes those who absorb it also feel really positive, and then nobody can access it.
So as we approach the end of the interview, can you tell our listeners where they can find more of you if they want to hear more from you?
Yeah, if you're not tired of me yet and you would love to hang out or kiki, you can definitely follow me on TikTok with the username @_Kelsifer. So that's _KELSIFER. If you want to watch the YouTube series, like the video component that comes along with the interviews, just look up Queer in Alberta. And if you want to listen on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Anchor, just type in Queer in Alberta as well. But the thing that I'm really excited about is if anybody wants to do an interview, they are still open. So if you go to my bio on TikTok and you have a story to share that you really feel like needs a larger audience, just click the link in there or email me directly at kelsifertiktok@gmail.com. That's KELSIFERTIKTOK@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for giving us your time today, Kelsey. We really appreciate that you came on and talked with us today.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, this is so flattering for me. You guys are in Vancouver and you know who I am. That's insane.
Well, we're excited to see more from you.
Oh, well, thank you. And definitely don't be strangers. It was so nice to get to chat with you as well. And, you know, being a mixed race anthropologist, intersectionality is my whole thing. So very happy to be here.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Mega Mall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City.
Oh, I see the love thickening over time.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
And we're back. Welcome back to Intersections. This is Phoebe. I'm going to be hosting our second interview of the day about TikTok. And this is, I feel a bit almost bad that I'm dragging this person back into talking about TikTok because they are now a very successful actor. And now we're just regressing back to their days of social media influencing. But I have with me Ruth Codd, former TikTok sensation, current Netflix sensation. You know her from The Midnight Club on Netflix. Go stream it if you have not watched it. And she's also going to be in the upcoming show, The Fall of the House of Usher. So hi, Ruth.
Bonjour. How are you?
I'm good. Ruth and I also actually know each other. We're actually good friends. So it's very awesome to have her on the show. We'll try to keep our laughter to a minimum for the radio.
We'll keep the inside jokes to a bare minimum. Promise.
Bare minimum. So maybe, Ruth, you could just talk a little bit about what you used to do on TikTok for those who, for some reason, don't know.
Oh, well, I liked your description of me. I'm going to write that down. What did I used to do on TikTok? It started off during the pandemic by accident. And then I kind of just became a creator, kind of against my own free will, really, because people just kept wanting me to upload. So I did. I used to do everything. I did comedy skits where I dressed up as a nun. I did vlogs, I did cooking videos, just me pissing about, basically was, just me messing about is what I did.
Do you remember, like, what made you start wanting to post on TikTok in the first place?
Pure boredom, because I was really bored during the pandemic and I had no job. Because I used to be a barber and I used to do hair and makeup for theatre. So obviously all that had shut down. And then it gets kind of like, I didn't ever expect anyone to watch. So once the views and stuff start going up, it gets kind of addictive. So I just kept going.
Oh, so the first time you posted was in 2020 during the pandemic?
During the pandemic, yeah. Yeah.
Did you use TikTok before that? Like, just were you watching TikTok before that? Is that when you first downloaded it?
I had it downloaded for about 2 or 3 months before I started uploading. It had kind of like, because it used to be like a dance app, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it had kind of just morphed from a dance app into like people just uploading like short YouTube videos, basically.
Yeah, I think that's when a lot of people first started using it, was like either just before COVID or of course during it, when
Yeah.
everyone was super bored and at home. And since then, it's like if you look at the numbers, it's exploded insane. Do you know how many users TikTok has? Like if you were to guess.
I'm going to say 1 billion.
It was they hit 1 billion last year, and now by the end of 2022, they're projected to hit 1.8 billion.
That's like a lot of the world.
Yeah, and that's not even like just a users, that's like monthly active users. So they probably have more users, but monthly active users, they're going to hit 1.8 by the end of 2022.
Oh my God. That's insane. I didn't realize it was that big. I was overestimating there with the 1 billion.
Yeah. So like we'll talk a bit about when you left TikTok later, but you're still using the app for fun now, I know, even though you don't post anymore. How much would you say you spend on TikTok every day? How much time do you get like your screen time report
Oh,
and you're like
I have my screen time right here. This is going to be very embarrassing.
I'll do mine too. We can do it together.
Because most of my screen time, I would say, is probably on TikTok. Oh, it's bad.
What?
Oh, it's yesterday. It was 9 hours.
On TikTok?
No.
No, that's total.
It total.
Okay.
I was on my phone for 9 hours yesterday. 9? That's probably most of the time I was awake. I would say probably a good 4 of those. I would say I spend 4 hours a day on TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, like an hour when you wake up, a good 2 hours before you go to sleep, and then, yeah, like an hour of miscellaneous just
Yeah.
opening up your phone and looking at TikToks.
I have a limit set for 30 minutes a day, but I almost always like cancel it. When I have school, I usually don't like go over that because I just maybe some, I have to get up and go and before bed, maybe I'll look at some. But the days that I don't have school, like I can definitely go on it for like over an hour or depends on the day.
You're very disciplined though. You're also like you're a get up and goer. I'm such a, so much more lazier than you are. Like I'm a sloth compared.
Well, thank you. I sort of have to get up and go. I don't like it, but I'm very excited to do nothing for a month over the holidays. So what do you watch on TikTok usually? Like what sides of TikTok are you on?
I don't like I'm not really follow anyone. I'm on what side of TikTok am I on? Well, like the gay side, obviously. Yeah, and then just like oh, at the moment it's what I ate today on an all-inclusive cruise. All those videos are coming up on my For You page. I love them. They're my favorite things.
I want to see those, but then that would just make me
Yeah.
hungry.
It does. It makes me snackish, but I just love looking at what people ate in a day. For a while, it did go into like what I ate today, like during a cut, and I'm like, I don't need to see this. Like, I don't want to see healthy ones. So now I
Yeah.
like look at people that eat loads, and I'm like, okay, that I can watch.
That's much more comforting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate diet videos and fitness videos on TikTok, and I still get them. I did a research project about like diet videos on TikTok a couple years ago, and they are awful. Like it's like almost the new like Tumblr, right? There's a lot of like eating
Oh,
disorder.
yeah. There's a huge amount. It did for a while. It got really bad there. And I don't know if it's just 'cause like my algorithm was picking it up and I kind of got stuck on it for a while. But yeah, I don't know if they're still as bad, but for a while there it was like basically Tumblr all over again. I was like, I cannot do this today. No, thank you.
Yeah, because I think the algorithm picks up those videos because they get a lot of engagement from our sort of demographic, like younger women. And then, so it'll spread and show it to us. But and then even if it gets like negative engagement, if people are commenting like this is bad or like using it as an example of all that, like it's still getting engagement and then it's still getting pushed more and more. Because some of those videos I see the comments are like, this is disordered eating, but it's like the video is still going around and has millions of views.
I think as well, it's like, do you know if you click on the comments to see, because obviously some of the videos are so like a little bit disturbing that you click on, like, it kind of curiosity kills the cat and then it gets stuck. You get stuck on that like side of TikTok. But I'm off it now, so we're all groovy.
Yeah, I started doing the thing where you say like not interested. Like you
can,
yeah.
That's a great feature actually.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I don't see them much anymore, but I was doing that forever. I kept doing it, not interested on every fitness video, and I would still see them. It's just like such a broad genre. They're like, are you sure you're not interested in this ab workout and diet where you eat only kiwi skin for 3 days? Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, it's like, do you remember when Frilly the Banana Girl on YouTube told us it was normal to eat half a watermelon for breakfast? Remember that?
She would eat like 30 bananas for breakfast. Like,
I know, I went vegan for like a month and I gave myself colic.
Yeah. I don't even want to think about what that woman's bowel movements looked like.
Let me tell you, I followed her diet for a month and they're not pleasant. Absolutely violent.
Absolutely foul. Well, to talk about, you know, bring it back to the sort of content that gets picked up by the algorithm or is really popular on TikTok, when you were posting, do you remember the type of content that you found would gain a lot of traction or perform best on your page?
It was weird because all the videos that I found funny that I thought would be funny and do well didn't. And then the ones that I find the things that do the most well are like when you attach something to a sound or like you voice over something. Like, it's weird. And then sometimes the algorithm can just pick up a video and it just snowballs. Like, it could be like a 5 second clip and it'll snowball and get like 5 million views for absolutely. I think you can just, with TikTok, there's no rhyme or reason to it. You can just be lucky and unlucky as to whether or not the algorithm picks you up.
Yeah. Do you remember any specific videos that were like your most popular? Is there one in your mind like that was my most popular video?
All the nun skits for some reason.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know why, because I still have them on my phone and I'm like, I hope nobody ever uploads them onto another platform. Like, I hope they die in the corners of the internet where they belong. I didn't find them funny, but other people must have.
I haven't seen those ones re-uploaded anywhere. There's some of your TikToks you can still find on the app. If you look up Ruth Codd and you're wondering what her TikToks look like, you can look her up.
Oh, but yeah.
None of those.
There's remnants of some. Yeah, there's remnants of some. There's like the ones that people stitched and stuff.
Yeah. If people stitch you, you can still see. The one of you where you talk about if someone stabbed your prosthetic leg, if that would legally be...
That was just a genuine question, and that got like 4 or 5 million views, and that was just a genuine question,
because a lot of lawyers would like stitch it and give their answer, and those videos got super popular too. I think I saw those videos when they were going around, like before I met you. Is when I see them now, I'm like, oh yeah, I recognize that. It's funny, you're like now sitting in Ireland in front of your wallpaper that all your TikToks were filmed in front of too.
I know, the old wallpaper is back.
Yeah,
we've come full circle. I'm back home in my childhood bedroom.
Your childhood bedroom. Well, it's a very nice wallpaper that nobody can see, so I guess maybe we should stop talking about what your wallpaper looks like. So now I'll have to ask, you quit TikTok in 2021. And how many followers did you have when you deleted your account, actually?
720,000. I say that as if I didn't check it before, like right before I deleted it. Yeah, it was 720,000.
It was 720,000. You're like,
I'm not unsure about that figure at all.
Of course you would know. I was trying to fact check this and figure it out. There was like, I found a TikTok, like the actual TikTok like website posted like a feature of you in like or like January 2021, and at that time you had like 670,000 followers. But you deleted it, and you said it felt, because it started to feel more like a job.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit more about why you think it started to feel more like a job than fun to you?
I think it was just like, again, the thing of becoming like obsessed with like figures and views and stuff. And if you didn't, upload every single day on TikTok at least once a day, like your engagement would go down, your views would go down. I just was like, why do I care? I'm like, I'm not a content creator. Why do I care about any of this stuff? It really doesn't matter. And I just didn't enjoy it anymore. It just became a chore. And I'm like, wait, like I would accept free stuff, but like I didn't really do a lot of the, like, I could have made a lot more money out of it if I wanted to, but I wasn't financially dependent on it and I didn't find it fun. So I was like, why am I doing this? So I just woke up one day and I was like, delete.
Delete forever.
Yeah.
So do you think the way TikTok works and the algorithm, like requiring you to post so often, it just puts pressure on creators to be having to constantly produce?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, obviously the more numbers you have, the more hate you get. I wasn't too bad on the hate front. I got away much lighter than most people, I think. But still, like, you'd just be having a bad day. And I used to, like, actively go look for hate comments then to make me feel worse. So I could just, like, wallow in self-pity. Yes, it puts huge pressure on people, especially if it's not, like, if you're not naturally good at editing and if you're not a writer. Like, fair enough if it's, that's kind of the thing you've always wanted to go into, but if you just have a normal job, it's a lot of time to put into something that doesn't really, apart from being present on social media, doesn't really have any other benefits.
Yeah. What made you decide to completely delete the account instead of just, like, stop posting?
Well, I'd stopped posting for a couple of weeks. And I don't know, really. I knew I wasn't ever going to go back to it. I think that was towards the end of Film and Club. And I just kind of knew acting was what I wanted to do and what I wanted to put my energy into from that point on. Like the whole, and again, I think it goes back to the thing, like, it all kind of happened very fast and very much by accident. So it's not really like it was something, I didn't work particularly hard for those numbers. And also the numbers didn't mean, I've never been big into social media, so it didn't mean a massive amount to me. Not that, like, I loved my followers and, like, engaging with them and all. And it literally got me the acting gig. So I'll always be so grateful for that and so grateful for them. But at the same time, I think it was a moment where I was like, I need to look after myself and step away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess we didn't mention that. For people who don't know, Ruth was cast for the Midnight Club from TikTok. So that's where she was discovered, because they did a really big search looking for an actor to play Anya that was a real amputee, right?
Yeah, and somehow they found me. Don't ask me how that conversation went. They were like, yeah, that's good. Let's hire someone with no acting experience at all.
Well, it clearly worked out. I don't need to sing your praises, because I think Mike Flanagan has done plenty of that. His word is better than mine. But Ruth is amazing in Midnight Club. Amazing actress. And I've actually watched her film some auditions as well. So really behind the scenes stuff.
Oh, yeah. Phoebe has seen some things. That is for sure.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. Just to go back again to when you first started to gain traction. I forgot to ask this earlier. Do you remember, was there one specific video that first blew up for you? And, like, was there a moment you remember, like, oh, whoa, like, now I'm really starting to get followers and get more views?
It was the first video I had that blew up was the video of, it was the first comedy skit I did, and it was a conversation between me and my dad's friend, who compared me being an amputee to his cat losing its tail to a lawnmower. And I didn't even write that. Like, that was a real conversation that I had. that's the first one that blew up. Yeah.
Oh, so it's interesting. You were talking about your amputation in that video.
Yeah. And then people were kind of like, put me in the whole disability advocate kind of thing. And that wasn't intentional either. That was just like, well, I'm just a creator that has a disability that sometimes makes a joke about it. So I was like kind of uncomfortable almost with being put in the advocate box, because I'm like, I'm not much of an advocate. Like, I just can't take the piss out of myself.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually, because, you know, if you, you know, all the articles that you've done, interviews with other outlets, and they talk about your TikTok and they sort of frame you as this like advocate for disability, visibility and awareness. And I was going to ask how it feels to be given that label and talked about like that. You said it feels a bit uncomfortable. Do you still feel that way, or was it just at first?
No, I still feel, because I feel like no one should be taking advice off me, really. So it's still when people call, I'm like, if you want to call me that, go ahead. But I don't think I really am one. You know, people dedicate their whole lives and their whole life's purpose to campaigning and raising awareness and stuff. And I'm like, if I accidentally did it by just being me on an app, then that's fine. But I most certainly don't expect praise or recognition for my work for the disabled community.
And it's like maybe a bit of pressure too. It's such a diverse group of people, to be sort of feeling, you know, any sense of responsibility to represent.
Well that's the thing, like I think a lot of the time disabled people are all like painted with the same brush, and I'm like, we're just like, and that's the issue, is that like we're not really seen as people. Like, you see our disability first, when realistically we're like people and we're all different to one another. Like, it's not like an exclusive club with entry requirements. Like, we're all completely different to each other, and we all deal with it completely differently. So when people ask me questions, I'll only ever answer for myself or speak for myself, because I don't know, you know, how other amputees deal with stuff, because I'm not them. And there's no right or wrong way to do it either, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it, you know, you were originally posting on TikTok just to, you know, just for fun, right? Not necessarily looking to post content about your disability.
No, and I did sometimes. Like, the odd time I would get annoyed about something and post about it. But for the most part, it was just me taking the piss, yeah.
Do you think TikTok has the potential, or from your time using it, or now using it now after you've deleted your account, stop posting yourself, do you think it has the potential to sort of give this visibility to more disabled people, and also like sort of confront that narrative that you said, where they're not seen as just like regular people, they see the disability first? Do you think it gives them a platform to talk about that?
I think it definitely does, because I think you're just obviously exposed to a lot more creators that also happen to be disabled, but like, not all disabilities are visible as well. So like, a lot of the time I used to, because obviously from TikTok you're posted from like the chest up, so like people would be like, then they'd be following me for a while, and then they'd see a video and they're like, oh, I didn't even know you were disabled. And I'm like, that's the point.
Yeah, it's like, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, so I think the app is like good for just like normalizing it. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because it's just, most videos, it's, that's a good point, are just your face or from like the neck, you know, of your neck. So the content created by disabled creators doesn't even have to be about that. And like, you know, people can never even know. And it's like, they can talk about it if they want to, but also it sort of forces you to see them, the, like their face, the person over it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
I guess that's one of the strengths of the app, and just the way it works, and it being videos, that it can sort of like, I mean, I don't know, people talk about TikTok as like, oh, it can empower marginalized voices, and the way they talk about social media in general, to just sort of this equalizing force. Everybody has like an equal voice.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any like limiting factors to TikTok?
I mean, yeah, like, you can be really, you know, creative, really funny, and the algorithm could just not pick you up. And that's the same way with all social media. And as well, like, it is a free for all, because you don't even have to have like a name on an account. Like, you can have, like, even under your one account, you can have multiple accounts. So like, people can just comment what they want. And again, if your video is picked up by the algorithm and you have like an influx, say it gets on the wrong side of TikTok and like a video about gay people gets on like the homophobic racist side of TikTok, like, then all the comments underneath that are going to be from those homophobic racist people. You know what I mean? So in that way, it really does depend on the audience that you reach, because if you end up on the wrong side of it, obviously your message is not going to get across to the people that it's going to make an impact on.
Yeah, it's harder to foster like a community, like maybe on other apps where you follow people. Of course you can follow people on TikTok, but the way most people use it is just the For You page, so you just sort of see whatever is thrown at you.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
In the same way, your content is then thrown at whoever the algorithm thinks will engage with it, and that doesn't necessarily mean that engagement will be positive.
Yeah, exactly. So that's probably the biggest downside to TikTok, and like, everyone's a fucking keyboard warrior when they don't have to even have a profile picture. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, yeah.
So where do you think, just from someone who's, we've established, uses TikTok a lot now,
yeah,
where do you think, like, the future of TikTok, where do you see it? Do you have any predictions of the future of TikTok or where it's going?
I'm not gonna lie, I really thought it would have fizzled out by now, like with most things. The other way, like, Facebook had its day, Instagram kind of had its day but is still around, like Twitter definitely had its day. Yeah, like Tumblr, all that. So my prediction would have been that it would have fizzled out by now, but it really hasn't. So I think it'll probably be like another YouTube, just with shorter videos. I think it'll change over time, like the format and the layout of it definitely will change. I think it'll become probably more a bit like YouTube, where you can pick and choose things, would be my prediction. But I'm no tech guru, so I don't really know.
That's great. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It seems like it's not going anywhere yet, so we'll see. It's just continuing to grow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Ruth, for being on the show and your time, taking time away from your very extravagant Hollywood lifestyle.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm currently unemployed, so I have all the time in the world. Do you want another half-hour interview? I'm free.
She's unemployed, everybody. Any casting agents out there?
Any casting directors? I'll take anything.
It's okay. Your phone will be ringing off the hook after you get your Emmy, so we won't worry about that.
I think I'll be waiting quite a while for that one.
All right. Well, we'll be right back after some messages for our last interview of the day. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
It's alive. Mega Mall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City. Oh, I see the love thinking over
time. Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B, as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Intersections. We're broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today, we're very excited to welcome Brianna Days. She's a Dene artist based in the Lower Mainland, Vancouver. So yeah, Brianna, welcome to Intersections. First, before we launch into our questions, is there anything else you would like to tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I am a reconnecting Olchaco Native person, and I go by she, her pronouns. I'm just a bead artist and online creator that loves to mess around and make earrings.
Awesome. Yeah, so we were listening to your previous interview on CITR on the show Unceded Airwaves with Cleo. We thought it was really fascinating, your growth as a TikTok artist. So during the interview, you mentioned that initially you posted beadwork on TikTok and the feedback has been really helpful as you were growing your arts during the pandemic. From that time when you were posting as a hobby to now running your full-time business, how would you say that this type of social media and also other platforms has changed your ability to connect with others through your artwork?
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing. When I first started posting, really, I was like, posting, you know, this is what I'm working on, this is how I'm doing it. And people would say like, oh, try doing it this way, or try doing this part a little bit differently, do it this way instead. And that feedback just helped me grow into the skill itself. And then from there, when it grew into me having those skills already and just putting out my artwork, it turned into now it's mostly like, oh, this is awesome, good job. Right? Not getting as many tips these days. But, you know, people still have great tips for me that I didn't know, which is awesome. But it's really made it so that it's like this total community that like talks back to each other. And it's unlike, I think, other social media, the TikTok native community, at least, because we are like so tight knit, the way that trends flow through the community and like through TikTok and how they move is so interesting. And I think the way that I've been able to connect with people through my art has just exploded from this. There's people who are seeing my art across the world. Like I'm getting a lot of people in the Philippines or Central America or just all over the place that my work has seen, which is crazy to me.
Yeah. So it's this like first person kind of connection to creators, to independent creators, especially, that we find particularly fascinating when we're discussing the influence of TikTok. And the influencers that have emerged out of it. Based on the kind of connection that you can make with people, we were also wondering, like, are there any negatives of being in the spotlight as a TikToker that your audience might not necessarily be aware of? Like, for example, due to the nature of the bite-sized content and the way that impressions are formed on there, or the comment section, for example.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who are kind of in the native Twitter niche are already familiar with like some of the negative comments you get, typically like along the lines of racism, or just in general, people not understanding culture, which can always be an issue. I mean, when it comes to art, you don't see that as much. But as soon as I say anything political, it's so easy for things to roll into different sections of like the TikTok audience who will take it one way or another, which is really interesting. And and then when it comes to otherwise, I feel like it's pretty good. There is always that thing as an artist where you have to keep up with making content every single day in order to stay relevant according to these apps and their algorithms. So there is kind of that way that it affects me, but that's more so like a, you know, internal having to be a slave to the social media platform, as opposed to negative interactions community-wise. I feel like it's a super welcoming community to be a part of.
This is another really interesting aspect that Juliana will be touching on, about like being able to highlight political issues on like other topics that people might not be so aware of yet. But for now, as we wrap up my section, you've also mentioned how following other Indigenous creators has helped with ideas for the art. Are there any other objectives that you were hoping to achieve when creating your artwork and sharing it online?
Yeah, well, these days, it's all about, I think, tutorials and making content and helping other Indigenous people learn how to bead, get better at beadwork, turn their beadwork into a full-time job like I've been able to, with the business skills that I've been able to pick up through university and everything like that, and just the trial and error of running this business.
TikTok today, like, yeah, it's like a whole marketplace. Like, you can market your own business, you can highlight certain political issues if you want to. So it's like a whole array of things that you can do.
Yeah,
we're just interested in like if there's like other areas that you haven't touched on in your previous interviews that you want to share on TikTok. And
I've definitely talked about teaching and stuff. I feel like it's just fun to see people's work as well. It's kind of like an online art gallery, like my Instagram feed these days, because of all the incredible artists that I get to follow and that I've found through TikTok, through YouTube, through Instagram, whatever it is. That can be inspirational. They can be friends sometimes. I've made a lot of friends, even in-person people, not just people I talk to online, through these communities and through beadwork. It's incredible.
And going into your Indigenous dolls, I've noticed there is emerging diversity of dolls, like on the general market, and dolls by Indigenous creators are helping to raise awareness about like Indigenous identity and also bring awareness to the way that people unconsciously might perceive Indigenous identity. So with that, I'll hand the floor over to Juliana.
Your dolls are super interesting. And I was scrolling on your Instagram and TikTok and your website today. Like, it's really impressive that you've been able to do what you're doing. And then from my understanding, you aren't an Indigenous activist, but you're like just using the platform to share your artwork. And your dolls are kind of political in the sense that they're kind of culture jamming, like the regular mainstream, like white, able-bodied, heterosexual Barbie. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of transforming them into these dolls that are so diverse and inclusive and really representative of Indigenous identity. In terms of how you present yourself and how you label yourself on social media, for you, where does the line like blur, or where do you draw the line between like activism and this political artwork kind of, and like in terms of how you're labeling yourself and presenting yourself on social media, like what are your thoughts, how are you navigating that?
Yeah, that is a really good question. It's probably why it took me so hard to comprehend what I'm even saying, but I find as an Indigenous artist, even as just an Indigenous person overall, kind of there's so many things that you do that are inherently political without even thinking about it. So when it comes to like reconnecting and, you know, really taking hold and connecting to my roots and, you know, saying loudly and proudly that I'm Indigenous, whereas my ancestors, my great grandparents, my grandparents didn't necessarily have that luxury. Whereas now I can say that and I can feel safe and I can do so much with it. So when it comes to doing beadwork, just create, you know, a pretty flower or something like that. It doesn't feel political, but in a sense, it kind of is in reclaiming the artwork. And then there's the work that I create that is a little more special, or maybe has a little more thought put into it. Work like that, it can definitely get really political. Like there's one piece that I made after Roe v. Wade was overturned in the U.S. And I took a paperclip and I bended it into a clothing hanging wire, and then beaded onto it what looked like dripping blood, and created something like really more controversial out of that. And then as well made a YouTube video teaching people how to make it, because a lot of people really liked it and thought it was pretty in addition. And so then that YouTube video I'm using as a fundraising channel, so that way that video, whatever it makes, I can donate back to abortion causes. So sometimes it's 100% of what the art is. Other times it's kind of a piece of it, but it's not necessarily outright overt or obvious.
Yeah, that makes sense, because we all know like the personal is political and like especially when you're creating this kind of artwork. Like, it is inherently political, but it's fantastic that you're using your platform and your artwork to raise awareness for certain like local issues that are happening. In the previous interview you did with CITR, I thought it was really interesting how you said you kind of base your donations on the current global things that are happening. So for example, in the previous interview, you talked about your red shirt, like the design, and how you donated the funds from like that YouTube video or tutorial to like a missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls organization. Yeah. Like, right? I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about like the thought process behind that, and like how you're using your artwork and your skills to kind of also donate and raise awareness for these causes. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's an important part. As someone who's like reconnecting too, I feel a lot of responsibility in what I'm taking and what I'm giving when it comes to Indigenous culture. Because in a sense, I am profiting from my culture, which is my right to do. But at the same time, I'm still like making money off of it. So I feel that responsibility that I should be giving part of it back. Like I mentioned in that last interview, at first I was just so surprised people wanted to give me money for my earrings that, you know, I'd barely been able to make at that point. And so I felt like I really should give it back because I didn't necessarily need it at that point. Like it was extra money. It was fun money. So why not? And then since then, I've tried to build that into my business again. So I'm trying to give back at least as much as I am taking, hopefully, like not when it comes to dollars, otherwise my business would be over. But when it comes to the whole thing, I want to be able to give back as much money I can, try and talk about whatever causes and do whatever activism I can, and as well educate other people and give them the opportunity to be as lucky as I am, or at least just enjoy beadwork and all the wonderful things about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. And this actually leads into my next question really well. In our previous section, or our previous show, 2 weeks ago, that was aired in the Indigenous TikTok section, we were discussing how there's this kind of idea or notion that a majority group expects minority groups to educate them on like certain issues within that community. So in Canada's case, a lot of settler Canadians kind of rely on Indigenous people to educate them about how colonialism is impacting Indigenous communities, and how there's just like that line between, there's the expectation of like that emotional labor and the educational labor that is, and it's like, it's not the responsibility of Indigenous peoples to educate settlers. It's like our responsibility to seek out the information for ourselves. But as someone who's like vocal on social media and like using your artwork to kind of raise awareness and make a political statement or just try to increase representation, have you ever experienced anything like that where like people on the app might assume or like rely on you for like an educational resource? Or how do you navigate that line between still doing what you love and educating people because you want to, but also not taking on the burden of all that extra emotional labor? Does that kind of make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of us get like, we know that a lot of people just aren't educated, and we are aware of that in our interactions and how so many people just assume, you know, stereotypes or, you know, just completely wrong history, whatever it might be that they have biases from that might make them act in anti-Indigenous ways or say things. So we kind of feel that responsibility without even anyone asking. That we have to educate people, especially when we have a platform, there's even more pressure to make sure that you are using that platform effectively. So I think there's like times when you feel really inspired, where you want to create educational pieces of content, whatever it may be. One thing I did was videos. There was this trend on TikTok. This guy was making TikTok 10 questions. If anyone ever saw those, and you do these little quizzes every day, and it was really fun. So I decided to indigenize the concept and do it on residential schools for Orange Shirt Day, I think, last year, 2021. And with that, it's like, after I did a few of those videos, it's like, it's exhausting. Like, it's, you know, it's one thing to, you know, do the research, double check your numbers, make sure it's all right, and then be very disappointed about the things you find, and then have to repeat those as you film them and think about it. And try not to just go total monotone and not, you know, make it all fit in 60 seconds as well. That's fun. And then pump it out. It's a weird experience. You're kind of like really condensing a lot of things when it comes to like that 60 seconds on TikTok, or, you know, sometimes Twitter, you barely get any space to say anything, whatever it may be. So it's kind of a weird balance where sometimes I'm really inspired to create, and then sometimes it really kind of bogs you down. And it's really, for myself, I think I have a lot of privilege too, being like a white native as well. So, and I didn't grow up on the res. My mom was in the 60s scoop. So I have, in that sense, a little bit of like that disconnect that makes the material a little more easy for me to work with. But at the same time, there's still so many things that still affect me as well, despite the way I look, that I have to, you know, talk about in order to do the activism I want to.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for people who are maybe less educated about these topics, who come across Indigenous TikTok, on how to navigate that space without being exploitative, or just you personally as a creator? Do you have any advice for other creators maybe who are trying to navigate that line between balancing doing activism and using that platform, but also protecting like your mental health and protecting your peace, and just making sure that it's not overwhelmingly or emotionally draining for you? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think maybe probably not answering DMs will be a good one, because a lot of people will, you know, reach out and try and ask questions. And it's like, if you tried to answer every DM, it gets impossible at one point. So like, that definitely would be something I'd advise against, that a few people probably do and then realize soon after that they shouldn't have, just because it can be way too emotionally overwhelming. And then even comments, like, some of them I leave and you just let someone else answer can be another good way. And, you know, that way people too can debate in the comments. It'll blow your video up. Who knows? You know, if and that really can be good for your mental health, just not replying, letting them do their thing. Turn the comments off if you really need to. But I think just separating yourself a little bit can be a little bit of help. But it's kind of hard to do too. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, no, it definitely sounds like a hard line to navigate. But at the end of the day, like, it is your platform, and the only, like, you're not obligated to respond. Like, no creator is obligated to respond to any comments or DMs. We are able to use these digital tools and these apps to push the content and promote the content that we want to create. And besides that, like, even if you have a social media following, I think it's important to recognize that you don't owe anyone any explanations or any response to the comments. So I'm sure that will be very helpful for people listening who maybe are trying to navigate a similar issue, or just like finding it hard to balance between like the activism and just enjoying the app, the social connections that come along with it, but also not being too emotionally drained. So thank you for your advice.
During our last Intersections episode, we have talked about how algorithms and on TikTok and other social media, sometimes it's good to be aware of how like the algorithm can be colonial in nature, and some content does get suppressed when it's created by like marginalized peoples. So as an Indigenous content creator, what has your experience been like with the app structure? Like, do you see Indigenous content not being pushed as much as other content?
I think I've been really lucky in tailoring my feeds on most of my social media, that I rarely see stuff that's not Indigenous, I feel like. That's what I love about TikTok, is that you can really, like, for anyone who is finding native TikTok and they are non-Indigenous and they want to navigate it, like, just sit there, scroll through the videos and let it kind of take over. I'm sure you can learn plenty from it. You'll enjoy lots of great humor and all that as well. Because that's what I've done with mine. And I feel like for myself, I'm just in a very nice little echo chamber that I enjoy with other Indigenous creators. And I think that's kind of been the best way, is you know, you have to kind of interact with the content how you want to see the content. So, you know, put good energy into the good videos that you like seeing and ignore all the other ones. And I find that helps a little bit, but at the same time, there's a lot of people I follow that I don't see their stuff. And it often will kind of go through cycles where you'll see certain people kind of pushed down, other people brought up, and you see that kind of cycle go through where sometimes I'll go months without seeing a specific creator because their stuff just isn't being pushed out. And it's hard to believe that their content has just all of a sudden become bad, or they haven't even changed their posting behaviors. But apparently, a lot of the mods are like teenage boys. So we can see that that probably isn't the best set of people to be moderating certain content, especially people who are underage, or they probably could use a little more diversity to help out in that regard. Because I've seen many, many rules going one way for one person and another way for another.
Yeah. So just to wrap up, like, as we've discussed before, like, sometimes as a content creator, it can be kind of overwhelming, like, having to educate people and then, like, respond to comments, and, like, there's lots of DMs and stuff. In your opinion, would it help a little if, after some people watch your videos, from an informed perspective, if they kind of make their own videos highlighting the issues, but also referencing your videos, like, as a source, do you think it might help to take the burden off, like, some creators?
Yeah, I think amplifying people anytime you can is good, especially if you have a decent following yourself. That can be really helpful. Just reposting content that's already made, because I feel like, you know, the same thing where people will ask, oh, well, what are we supposed to do about residential schools? They ended forever ago. And it's like, well, we do have this nice thing over here called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission with 91 calls to action, exactly telling you what we already want from you. So it's like, it's kind of the same thing where I'm sure maybe not every single issue, but the majority of it issues affecting Indigenous people have probably, that content's been made, it's been put out there by incredible people. And we can amplify it and really help them with that, because I find we are repeating ourselves a lot. You know, every Halloween, it's, you can't dress up as an Indigenous person, please remember that. And so many other things that sometimes just keep happening again and again. But yeah, I think amplifying, reposting, sourcing us is fantastic. And anything like that would be fantastic to take kind of the load off us and use our content and keep pushing it out.
Thank you so much for joining us today. For anyone who's interested in checking out Brianna's TikTok, her handle is at Art by Brianna Days, and she also has links to her website and other platforms. So yeah, check her out, and hopefully you'll get some insight and inform yourself at the same time.
Thanks for listening to Intersections by CITR's Intersectionality Collective on 101.9 FM. We would love to be reached by email at intersectionalitycollective@citr.ca or on Instagram at intersectionality_CITR. Send us your comments, feedback, and episode ideas. You can also find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program, and our theme song is provided by Young and Sexy. Tune in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., 2 weeks from now, for the next episode.